This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
We appreciate you taking some time out of your 50 Shades of Grey screening. Oh my goodness sakes, to join us. Last week we had former, and those are the best kind, Doc. Seriously.
They are all. I said that when we started this show, that the best politicians are former politicians, because you'll get a lot more candor. I mean, with somebody is, and I see this on all the shows, the Meet the Press, when you get the current politician, you can almost figure out what the script is in advance, because you know what their position is, and they're just going to try to say it.
Right. So we had John on. So John Shattuck was here.
Yeah, my big surprise is no real fan of John Boehner.
Well, no.
The current Republican Speaker of the House. Now, he did run against him once.
But how does that surprise you? And the reason why I ask why that surprises you is because he was reelected as House Speaker by not the largest of margins. It wasn't a unanimous choice for Speaker John Boehner. So I don't think that surprised me at all.
And unanimity is the rule. I mean, if you get 10 votes against, that's usually a sign of big problems, because everybody's afraid to vote against the guy who's going to win.
Well, the guy who's going to win is the one that appoints you to your all of your committees. Yeah. So, yes, that's the guy holding all the power. So, yes, you want to vote for the guy that you know is going to win. You want to bet on the fastest horse. Some bet against him as a protest vote, and they got squashed from their committee. So I'm not too surprised.
My takeaway is that he thinks that basically that Boehner hasn't seized control over Congress, and that he's being led around by factions that are largely outside of his control.
I didn't get that from him. What I got from him mostly was the reason why I said that Boehner was a horrible choice for Speaker of the House, because he wants the parking space. That's why John Boehner wants to be there. John Boehner has no interest in sitting down and laying out a blueprint for a better America. John Boehner is there for the power, the pay, and the parking space, period.
Well, the limo.
Power, pay, parking space, period. See how I did that? I love alliteration. See how I do?
I did a very insightful interview. I do think it was probably 75% good insight, maybe 25% predictable talking points. There's one of those.
Well, there's 25% has got to be at least his core values, his core belief. Yeah. He's not going to sell everyone.
Here's where, and I didn't want to interrupt him because it was so fascinating. The one place where I diverged from, he was basically faulting the president for the State of the Union speech, which basically consisted of the president's giving you what his agenda was. Now, that's the norm. That's what he gets elected. He gets to state what he believes in. Mm-hmm. I think it's completely unreasonable to expect him up front to negotiate with himself before stating what he believes. It's the norm. The president gets to lay out his agenda. Now, that agenda is going nowhere in this Congress.
As the rest of his State of the Union addresses in his agenda has gone squat.
Well, early on, we got Obamacare. We got a whole lot of...
We got Obamacare. It's big. That's what we got.
It's big.
You're saying president's is in six State of the Union addresses, he got one thing done.
We got a stimulus bill. We got the economy turned around. There's a whole lot of stuff.
We'll save that for next Sunday.
But that happened with a Democratic Congress. But I think the point I'm making here is that the norm is the president gets to state in the State of the Union what his position is. Sure. I would be disappointed if he did anything less. But a lot of the commentary from the other side was, this shows he's not willing to work with us, which I say baloney. I say, let the president state his position. Let the Republicans, which they did in the counter argument and in all the commentary, let them state their position. Okay. From there, you go to, but you don't ask somebody to negotiate with himself.
Okay, but he did say that very clearly. I wish I had the audio to pull up, but he said that very clearly, that he wasn't going to negotiate. He's going to veto anything that he doesn't agree with, period.
If you pass a no compromise bill, I'm willing to compromise, but if you're passing Republican agenda bills, which the Congress clearly can, without consulting the Democrats or taking the president into account, yes, he'll veto.
coming from the man that called bipartisan support Olympia Snows on the program. That's, you see what I mean? That's not bipartisan or compromise when you have one R with you.
No, it's not.
At all.
No.
And same with the Republicans. It's not compromise when there's one D involved.
In other words, if you, what he's saying is, if the Congress passes a bill without significant Democratic participation, which they have the right to do legally, it's going nowhere because the president, who was elected twice, has the right to veto, and he said, I'm willing to do that.
Okay. And he did say that. Right. And what the mockery was from the right was that they got a thumping in the last election. The Democrats took a thumping.
Yep.
And he ignored that. He said, I know the will of the people now, and forget that noise. It's my
will. He was also elected twice. 2012.
This elected twice nonsense.
2012, the Republicans took a thumping, and they ignored that. Like, they both got their own agenda. And essentially, nobody has set up a situation that would preclude people sitting down and negotiating if they have the will to do
so. Going back to Boehner. Boehner is a perfect example of both parties at this point. He is a perfect example of D.C., a perfect example of your elected officials. Your elected officials. He's a perfect example. He wants to smoke his cigarettes, drink his wine, have the limo, and the power and the paycheck. That's it. If he got nothing from his interviews that he did with Mitch McConnell, I don't think he's been paying attention for the past 90 days, at least. I think the questions that were being asked to him were a surprise. That's all you got from him. Yep. I wasn't surprised that Shattuck said that a bunch of people aren't a fan of John Boehner.
Well, if they're inclined, I'm saying the door could still be open, that Boehner, McConnell, and the president could get together and say, all right, I don't think there's any common ground, as John Shattuck pointed out, but there is room for compromise. In other words, on the basis of you don't get everything you want, I don't get everything I want. If they're not willing to do that, then basically, let the cameras roll. We're into the 2016 election and nothing's going to happen to them, which would not be good for them.
We'll get to it a little bit later in the show, but we will talk about the president asking for approval to go to war. It seems like, okay, well, now I'm going to give the Republicans what they want. Let's go invade somebody. Let's have a good old invading and everybody get together on this one. And the Republicans are looking at him thinking, well, you just won two elections on anti-war and thumped us. What do you want us to do now? We're kind of painted into a corner. We're going to talk about that a little bit later as well. But this big news this week, NBC took a hard line. I was actually surprised by this. A 6-month suspension of Brian Williams without pay. I'm going to tell you how much money that actually equates to, and we'll give you a media eye view of exactly what this looked like next on The Think Tank.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we're back in the Think Tank. Media introspective, Brian Williams. Everybody's talking about it. Mike, I'd like your take on that one first.
If you've been hiding under a rock somewhere and haven't noticed that NBC's, I would say, darn near America's Anchorman, got caught, let's say, fudging a story about being in a helicopter and being shot down in Iraq. Said that. Come to find out, that's not true.
Yep.
Didn't do that. So he embellished
elements of truth, but not true.
Bold-faced lied. Now, I spoke to people in our newsroom about this, because don't call me a journalist, trust me.
Okay.
I am merely a commentator. So the journalists that I have spoken to, I asked them a very pointed question. I asked, does tragedy or pain or suffering in your own, could be physical, could be mental, emotionally, if you're stuck in some sort of trauma, does that help your career? All of them, every single one of them said, the ugly answer is yes.
Credibility. Gives you credibility.
You're the guy.
I took fire.
Look at Wolf Blitzer.
Was
he was the Scud Stud. Remember that?
Right.
Wasn't he the Scud Stud back in the day? Wolf Blitzer? No, he was there, though.
Peter Arnett was the big guy. I mean, he had missiles flying in the background.
That's so good for your career. Yeah. It's those poor weathermen that are stuck out in the tornado.
That was the first Gulf War. That was the first war where we got to see what was going on the other side in real time.
Right.
I mean,
right.
I mean, I remember him saying, you know, there's a missile turning down and it's turning right at such and such a street and there it is.
But then on the other side, you have Geraldo Rivera who tells everybody in the world exactly where they're at and their point and position in the stand. And he's still getting work. But let's get back to Brian Williams. Tragedy helps you in this business. It does. If you're caught or you're shot down, if you're in a firefight, if you're in some gunfight down in Central Phoenix, it helps your career. Having said that, you need to be trustworthy.
Absolutely.
The people need to be able to trust you. So, did I believe Brian Williams' apology? Absolutely not. Do I think that he meant to do what he did? Yes, he meant that for his career, and he makes $10 million a year now, and now he's losing five of those, suspended without pay for half of a year. I believe in second chances. I hope he rebounds because he's good at his job. He lied and he got busted on.
I think he's gone from the nightly news. But let me backtrack.
Really? You think after 6 months he won't come back?
Let me take the long way and show you how I get there.
I took the long way. Go ahead, buddy.
First of all, I have two interpretations of his statement. The first and the one that most people are taking is that it was hyperbole. He was bragging. He was trying to give himself more credibility as a result of that. And that interpretation may, in fact, be true. It's also possible that in a situation like this, you kind of come to believe what you said. And let me talk a couple things about how this story evolved. First of all, this came out when he said, "Oh, we were in this helicopter and we took RPG fire." And when he got first challenged, it was by the lead helicopter that actually did take RPG mm-hmm. fire. And this guy got on the air and he said, "Hey, buddy, I was the one who took the fire. My helicopter went down and you weren't there."
Sure.
And he started to look like that thing was made from whole cloth. In the last couple of days, the pilot of the helicopter that Brian Williams was in has also spoken up. And he said, "We did take fire. It was not RPG fire. Mm-hmm. We were not forced down. We ultimately landed." Now, the most benign interpretation would be this. You're a civilian. All of a sudden, you're getting shot at. Okay,
mm-hmm. Right.
You're hearing bullets going. You're not hit, but you're getting shot at, and it's a big deal to you.
Yeah.
Okay. You're not insulated.
There's alarms going off, gunfire
and over boom, some bang, time, yeah. And you're scared, and there's real bullets.
Amen.
And you kind of conflate that.
Yeah.
You know, and you make a statement that's wrong, but I think it's within the realm of possibility that he came to believe that. I don't know, and it's not an absolute defense because I find the other interpretation that he basically embellished the story a little bit. I find that a little bit.
Well, I find that believable. I'll go with you on this because yeah. I have a friend of mine, and I'm not going to name any names because he probably works here. He tells some stories that aren't his own. But he has told them so many times, he believes them as his own.
Exactly.
And I'm not.
And he
bashing,
may really believe them.
Yes,
at this
might
point.
Really yeah. believe them yeah. because they've been told so many times over and over again. So, and I'm sure Brian Williams. How many people have asked him about that one incident? And if he tells the story the same way, yeah. that man in his heart of hearts might truly
and
believe
the
story.
By the way, there is a whole social science literature on created memories. And it's very consistent with this. You
sure.
tell a story yourself, or there was a famous case some years ago of a mother and a son were running a child care center, and there was suspicion of child abuse. And they interviewed all these kids, and this was before they learned to tape record these. And the kids all came back with the same story, and everybody decided these people were monsters, and they had to be put away. Well, it turns out the reason the story was the same is that the person who was interviewing them had a version of what had occurred and implanted the same memory in all the kids, and so they all gave the same story.
Sure.
And so we've learned a little bit about that, and there are people who – and I do court testimony on mm-hmm. this kind of stuff from time to time, and memories – sort of direct memories of people are very frail. And you know what is really surprising about that? The certainty with which you hold a memory, you know, I said, "Well, you tell me a story." And I said, "Well, how sure are you?" And you say, "I'm absolutely positive about that." The certainty with which people believe a memory has no association with whether it's actually a fact or not.
Right.
So there are memory problems. But at the same time, I want to say, I am convinced here's his career's toast and here's why. He's paid $10 million a year, mm-hmm. basically to be credible and to attract ratings. I think about 9.9 of that is for the credibility. About 100,000, maybe 200,000 of that is for being a really good journalist. The rest of it is, I mean, you know, the networks are filled with good journalists, but only one of them gets the big kahuna slot to yeah. anchor the nightly news. And I find it difficult to see how he retains that mantle of credibility when a plurality of people think that he's making up the story. And I'm telling you, I don't know if I'm one of them or not.
You know? I think he can. I think he can weather the storm, because it's not as if he was standing next to Lee Harvey Oswald and he lied about who shot JFK, but, although he probably thinks he was there.
If you go to the internet,
it is filled with these,
you know.
So much fun.
Brian Williams at Appomattox, Brian Williams crossing Valley Forge.
Yeah.
He's become the butt of a joke. So I think the 6 months away was probably negotiated between him and the network, both of them realizing he's too much the story right now, that what he has to do is go away for 6 months. And my guess is the network takes a wait and see attitude and see whether
and we're
or not.
America. Yeah. We forget. Yeah. 6 months. Yeah. They know us.
That's a long time.
They know us. We forget. We forget.
So I think he's an asset they'd like to keep. But whether or not they can pull that off, you're right. Maybe in 6 months we've forgotten it and we've moved on and we feel like he's served penance. But right now, he's got credibility problems.
Because right now he looks like an asset minus the et.
Yeah.
That's exactly what Brian Williams is looking like. Doug Ducey, do you hear the ticking in the background? That's right. Doug Ducey has a ticking time bomb, and it has to do with the budget. We'll tell you what that is next.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Doug Ducey is our new governor, and he's got a budget out, and I was excited about that. I love it when somebody comes down, sits behind his desk, and gets to work. When was the last time our congressional leaders had a budget?
A governor and a president has to act.
Okay,
because
just kick that thing down the can. Don't you worry. Just kick that can down the road. Doug Ducey, you say, Doc, that there's a budget time bomb coming, the tick, tick, tick that you hear. What is that?
Sure. First of all, he has a problem that's not of his own making. He inherited a $500 million deficit, $1 billion next year. That's not of his making, but he ran for the office, so it's now his problem.
Amen.
You know?
Yeah.
And the first, the big ways that he dealt with it were pretty much things that he signaled in his campaign. He says, no new taxes. There are new corporate taxes that are scheduled, tax cuts that are going to come online. I'm not going to touch them. That's very much consistent with his platform. Most of the cuts are coming in education. That was also pretty much, if you read between the line in the campaign, that's pretty much what he said he was going to do. He fudged some of the stuff about, and he's holding firm on not setting aside money to pay what the courts have had to say that they have to pay in terms of getting education funding back up to voter-approved levels. But I think it's hard to fault him for that, because that's pretty much consistent with his campaign.
Okay, there you go.
Now, there's one little item in there, though, that I think is a potential huge item over the long run.
The time bomb.
The time bomb is that he's proposed one area of an increase, small increase now, but it's going to cost us big time over the long run, and that is 3,000 prison beds. And the reason it doesn't cost us any more right now is that they are using private prisons, so they upfront the cost of that. So the cost to us the first year is only $5 million, which isn't even rounding error in mm-hmm. the state budget.
Right.
But the cost of running those is about $100 million a year. And once you build those things, you're going to fill them. You make a 20-year commitment to private prisons. But once they're built, that's a 40-year commitment. That's a $4 billion commitment. And this is, to put it in perspective, that's now big money. The state budget, discretionary budget, is about $9 billion. Now, this is, of course, over 40 years, but that is a $44 billion expenditure that is going to get committed if we build these prison beds. And that is that's the long-term budget buster. Even though we're in austerity, other than that, that one is going to have long-term implications. And I think as a society, as a state, we got to ask ourselves, do we want to keep on warehousing people in great numbers? By the way, perspective on this. The United States imprisons more people than every country in the world except one, and you probably couldn't even pronounce that country. I'm not.
It's an Azakstan or something.
It's an island in the Indian Ocean, the Seychelles Islands. And it's you know, it's a outcropping, and just on a, as a percentage of population, they have a few more.
Yeah, they arrest two people. It's got 50%.
Right, exactly. Right. So basically, compared to any country that's a real country in the world, we're number one. Secondly,
we're number one
within the state of Arizona. We're in the top 10%. There's a handful of southeastern states that are higher than we are, but we're right up at the top. So the U.S. is number one. And by the way, to put
you can get elected on that, Doc. You can get elected on cleaning up the streets.
Oh, sure. Sure.
Can't you?
Let me give you the numbers here. Okay. We incarcerate 707 people per 100,000. Okay. Compare this to Egypt, 76, Germany, 78, Austria, 98, Italy, 100, France, 103, China, 102, 120, or 170, depending on which.
Okay, now that's in China, though, you got to let's take China out of the equation. Let's seriously knock China out of the equation, because incarceration versus just put them to death is just a whole different ballgame.
So the point is,
they put thousands of people to death a year.
But let's put this in perspective.
I'm with you on the perspective. We just got to knock China out.
Compared to any country in the world, we are not only one, it's like not close. We are six, seven, eight times.
It's the American way. We're number one. We're going to romp the score.
So the question is, how much higher do we want to go, and how much safer? And really, are Americans more violent and law-abiding than any other country on the world?
It's the stupidity. The stupidity of our sentencing. It's the stupidity of the three strikes rules. It's the stupidity of the nonviolent drug offenders. It's absolute lunacy.
Well,
what we have going on.
It's the politics. It's always safe to say lock them up.
Yeah.
Anybody who proposes the other side, saying we're incarcerating a little bit too many, if you let 10,000 of our prisoners out. Mm-hmm. In the state of Arizona, I guarantee you one of them somewhere is going to do something bad.
Then lock them all up again.
Now, here's the logical fallacy about that. Take a random sample of 10,000 normal law-abiding citizens who've never done anything wrong. One of them is probably going to do something bad, too.
Amen.
And so, but you won't have the political blowback from that. People will make the causal connection of you let a lot of people out, and somebody somewhere did something bad, and now this is the old Willie Horton thing. You know, they're going to run an ad and saying, you let this monster out, look what he did, and we're not safe because you let people out. But the cost is unlimited budgets for prison and law enforcement.
You and I aren't going to disagree on this. I think you and I will walk lockstep on our prison system and how we can reform that and make it once again, it starts with one step and one decision and one agreement, I would say, that you have to agree what prison's for. What is it there for? Is it to hide people, just remove them from society? Is it to reform people? What is it for?
I think criminologists will tell you it's all of those things. I mean, it is, punishment is part of it. I mean, their crime, you know what crime is least likely to recidivate?
Which?
Murder. Most of it's crimes of passion. Most of the victims are spouses. And the person who commits that crime is in almost 0% probability of recidivating. But you want to lock that person up as a punishment. You want it to be to say,
yeah,
no,
murder, no bueno.
We don't. This is not okay. And it's not because you're going to do it again. It's because we disapprove. We do it to incapacitate people. Mm-hmm. In other words, that's somebody who's a bad actor, and we're afraid they're going to do something again because they got a history of showing that.
Right.
Rehabilitation is also a goal. You know. And you have two kinds of deterrence. You got specific and general. I want to lock you up to deter you from doing something again. But for certain types of crimes, I also want to lock you up who did something bad as a signal to the rest of the world. This is particularly important in economic crimes, you know, where people are more rational, economic, calculating, you know, embezzlement or something like that. It doesn't strike fear into our hearts, but we do want to signal to other people, say, if you do that, there's a big, big downside that's out there. So all of those are legitimate purposes. But the question, I don't question any of those, including punishment. The question is, how many people, how long? And here's
how long is that? How many people? I don't care. Anybody commits a crime that's jail worthy, guess what? You go to jail. If everybody does it, everybody goes to jail. I'm saying the time. The time is the sentencing is our problem.
And the other thing is that I'm saying also that there are things other than imprisonment that can be very punitive.
Yes.
You know, you can put people to you can say, and I'm not saying 100 hours of community service. What was 1,000? What was 10,000?
Yeah.
I mean, that's 5 years of labor. Okay.
Yes.
There are options
that we can do
that can be sufficiently punitive where that's called for and cost us a whole lot less.
And save us money.
Yep.
That's free labor.
Yep.
That's what I like. I like the free labor part of it. But going back to, I'm going to go back real quickly here. I want to go back to this education deal. I'm not excited about the, how many millions of dollars are we dealing with here? With the judgment?
Oh, it is,
$300
million is what they have, they are currently underfunded relative to what the voter mandate said.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's an aggregate liability of $1.5 billion. In other words, that's they haven't paid this for 5 years. Now, the education people have said, listen, we'll settle. We don't need a nickel of that. Okay.
Okay.
But that's what that, in other words, if you have $300 million for 5 years, it comes to $1.5 billion. The education people have said, we know we're never going to get that back, but we just want to be made whole from here on out.
Okay.
So that's the difference between the $1.5 billion and the $300 million.
Here's the reason why no one's up in arms, Ducey, not letting that through. Because we know it's not going to get to our students. It just doesn't. Money does not get to our students. We're talking about, what, Apache Junction, Tucson, closing schools, consolidating elementary schools because there's no budget for it? But how many superintendents are we going to have making those decisions? Oh, it's driving parents nuts, and that's why Ducey's getting a pass on it. I would say he's getting a pass because we're tired of this. Our school budgets. It's asinine.
You get a pass until people start to feel it directly. If you start to look in your kid's class that had 25 now has 35.
Going on, and I'm bringing supplies to the class. I feel it, but I know that the $300 million comes. I'm still bringing supplies next year.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still bringing supplies. Man, it's called a budget. People work it out. For the love of grief. President Obama.
By the way.
What? I'm about to get to POTUS. What's up?
No, budget. We still had big raises for governor's staff and for legislative staff.
Well, yeah, because they're legislative staff. They deserve that. They deserve. Oh,
well, they're people that their legislators see one-on-one, you know, so they get to see it. Education system is a step removed.
Everybody should be paid the median income of the state. How about that? And if we all get a raise, you'll get a raise. Hey, look, I'm solving problems here. President Obama, prayer and war. That's right. Big week for prayer, big week for war. Next.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Amen. There you go. We just had the prayer breakfast right here on the Think Tank. Check that out.
Yeah.
President Obama. Now, the prayer breakfast. This is a big thing for a president. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of ribbon cuttings and baby kissing and team jerseys and all this stuff that presidents have to do. The prayer breakfast, I will say, is one of the most scrutinized things that a president does. I would say that, especially with President Obama, which half of the country, I would guarantee, Doc, half of the country says the man is a pray three times a day Muslim. But so we hear the prayer breakfast.
So we pay a little extra attention.
We think, hey, whoa, wait a second. What is he going to say at the prayer breakfast? And he didn't disappoint.
Yeah. And it's gotten a lot of blowback because what he said, which was something I think that was historically inarguably true, but a lot of people said he shouldn't have said it, is, hey, Christianity hasn't always been perfect. We have the Crusades. We had slavery. We, you know, people were burned in you know, post-Reconstruction America less than 100 years ago. So,
which takes that half of the country and said, see, he's a Muslim.
Yeah, yeah. So my take, first of all, you know, it's a prayer breakfast. Isn't that where you're supposed to say, dear Lord,
hey,
we haven't been perfect?
Amen.
But there are folks that didn't like it who wanted to make the other statement, the other part of that, that I think is true and should be said, though I'm not sure it should have been said in the prayer breakfast, is, yeah, but that really bad stuff about Christianity, that's a ways back. You know, the issues that are going on with fanatical Muslims right now,
is
the here and now.
Right.
And I think it is appropriate that that be asserted, though I'm not sure that the prayer breakfast, is the place,
not the time.
Is the place to be humble and to yes. admit your sins. I thought that was the Christian notion
Big
of what that's
confessional.
For. But he got a lot of blowback on that.
And he should have.
You know.
He should have.
You think so?
He should. Absolutely he should have. Because, but I'm going to say, and you know my feelings of Barack Obama. You know my feelings, so I don't hide those. But this is right at his playbook. This is his MO. This is what he does. This is his gig. Mm-hmm. They did it before me. But look at what they did. You might think this is bad, but look what they did. This is, it's been since he became the president of the United States. I know I know what I'm doing is shady, but hey, they did it. But the W's did
I'm
it.
I'm not sure that the prayer breakfast is where it's we want our warrior president to
okay.
be.
Okay, I'm telling you. You know? That's exactly what I'm telling you. It was the wrong time, but this is what he does. He said, I know everybody's mad at Muslims. I know everybody's mad at them right now. Look what Christians did. Look what you guys did. It's what he's done. I know you're mad we didn't get a budget, but we haven't had one in the last administration either. It's what he does.
Again,
it's his
context.
MO.
Now, we have, in another context, we have the warrior president. He's gone to Congress.
Here he is.
And he basically is asking for powers. But I think he's asking for fairly modest powers. He is not asking for what George Bush asked for in 2002.
He doesn't have to.
He does. Well, because he doesn't want it.
No, he doesn't have to, Doc. Understand this. He doesn't have to ask for what W asked for because he's still riding that wave on the same past piece of legislation. Two of them, by the way, 01 and 02. He's still running on those. Yeah. He still has carte blanche. He can do whatever he wants militarily because we're still fighting the war on terror that was passed by Congress in 01-02.
But it is fair to ask Congress to affirm it. If this is not, you know, the president has the innate power to do stuff. You know, he can respond militarily to an emergency, to an individual circumstances. But the moment it becomes a sustained activity involving lots of people, war powers say, you go to Congress and you got to get authorization. And that's what he's doing here.
You know, once again, you know my feelings of Barack Obama. My hat's off to him here because he is going. He skirts every now and again. In this one, he's doing the right thing and he's going to Congress.
And he's not really asking for anything that we're not already doing. He's not asking for 100,000 troops on the ground. He's asking for, you know, the right to do bombing, to have people who can, you're going to have boots on the ground in limited way, rescue operations, things like that.
Now,
you know, I'll say one other thing about this that I think is a really good development. And that is, I mean, it took a tragedy to do it, but you look at what's going on with the Jordanians. Mm-hmm. They are peeved.
Yeah.
The Jordanian Air Force is their pride and joy. When they burned that airman, that country is ticked off. And
that's a leader right there. I mean, I'm sorry. The king is a leader. He is a real leader. He throws on his camo. Where's my helicopter? I'm going to go take the fight to them. That's a real leader.
The beauty of that to me is that my biggest fear about the Middle East is the surest way to lose the war is to make it an American war. If we are in there and it becomes us against the indigenous people, whoever they are, then you're going to bring together the Shia and the Sunni and everybody else to deal with a foreign army. However, the Jordanians are indigenous. Now, you think we're not there. Those planes they're flying, where were they made?
Right here.
Those pilots, where were they trained? Every
right
one
here.
Of them. And those bombs, where were they made?
Right here.
Okay. So
there's always money in war.
But it's not, we don't, it's not our face out front. And that's why I think that can potentially be more effective than with us. The problem is if we become, we're an alien force. And if it's our face on it, we lose.
Okay.
We can win battles, but we lose wars.
Now, he's asking for a 3-year sunset. Ask for a 3-year sunset. That's what I don't like. That's why it irked me immediately, and it made me want to throw something through the TV. There's two things that made me want to throw something through the TV. The first was the 3-year sunset. You got 2 years left in your term.
I think that's about right.
Two-year sunset. Let the next administration, next Congress, then debate once again if they want. I don't care if you've got to go 2 years and 4 months or whatever it is. Let them debate and renew, because now the will of the people get to speak in 2016, whether we want this or not.
Yes.
And then they come in.
Essentially what you're trying to do is not make the new president, whoever that is, have to immediately deal with this, excluding all else.
I mean,
I think the Republicans particularly like this. They think they might have somebody in the Oval Office. They want to have a new president have a year window before they have to, because big military action, you don't turn on a dime on those.
We're
you have to
always
build them
in
up.
A big
so
military.
It takes us
action.
A year to get out. So
all right.
So I think that's to give a little bit of breathing space to a new president.
Said he didn't want to get on the ground. Doesn't like those ground troops, although we have so many ground troops out there, my eyes hurt. Mm-hmm. They're advisors, but they're heavily armed advisors. He said he didn't want to get on the ground. He said that our allies in the region know it best, so they're going to take the ground fight to ISIS. Who?
Well,
wait a second. Who? The ones that have already just turned tail and ran every time ISIS, they see an ISIS flag? Those guys? Who? Afghanis? The Iraqis? Who?
I always cringe when we ask for something called quote-unquote training, and I don't see training. Training isn't the issue. The issue is loyalty.
Okay.
The issue is, what side are you on? I mean, the number of wars where we spent, I mean, we can go back to Vietnam. We spent unbelievable time trying to, quote, train the South Vietnamese. How could they get beat by essentially the same people who didn't get any training? The difference wasn't training. The difference was motivation.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's our face on it, we're the infidels, okay? There has to be indigenous Muslim forces and entities within the Middle East that gather popular support.
Okay, I agree with that.
And the hard part in some of these countries is trying to figure out, are there good guys there anyway?
But this goes back to the beginning of this whole ISIS problem, when President Obama said our giant team that we're going in there with all of our allies in our I forget the word he used, mm-hmm. and I'm drawing a blank on it right now. But and then we went and there was no one there with us. I think France came in, but surrendered immediately.
Or we're going to take down Assad without looking to say with whom.
Thank you. Yes. But you say we have this coalition. We have this giant coalition and nobody's there. Yeah, he said, we're going to take it to ISIS, but we need these guys on the ground. They are not going to come along with us, period.
Right now, Syria is half Assad, half ISIS, and a handful. Yeah. We're still looking for the. God, I give up on democratically oriented, but at least somewhat decent. I mean, Jordan is a great model. I mean,
Jordan's a great
not
model
democratic,
of leadership,
but yeah,
is an example of leadership. That's what a leader does. Yeah. What a leader. Doc, this has been fun. It's a good show. I like it. Thanks, buddy. All right. Hey, thanks for spending some time with us. On behalf of Doc O'Neill, I'm Mike Russell. Been right here in the Think Tank, KTR News.